I want to finish the section on self-deception in the greater study on deception this morning. And if you remember last time we left off, we were on page 32. We're down at the middle of the page on point D. But I had been talking about the importance of knowing ourselves and how it's you would think it would be impossible not to know yourself since you are yourself. But as I mentioned yesterday, that it is quite often the case that we don't really know ourselves. We like to trick ourselves and make ourselves think that we are, you know, we're different or more noble or something than we actually are. And another thing that can tie into our self-deception is when God does give us strength and he gives us success, then we let that strength and that success make us think that we're greater than we actually are. And we'll deceive ourselves. In Jeremiah 49 and verse 16, Jeremiah was prophesying against Edom. You remember Edom are the descendants of Esau, and Esau, of course, is the man that is symbolic of the reprobate in the Bible, being one himself. But anyway, here in Jeremiah 49 and verse 16, it says, "Thy terribleness hath deceived thee, and the pride of thine heart, O thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock." So the clefts of the rock, like way up on the side of the mountain, you know, you're dwelling up there, you're on high, you're quite proud of yourself because of your station in life. "That holdest the height of the hill, thou that shouldest make thy nest, though thou shouldest make thy nest as high as the eagle, I will bring thee down from thence, saith the Lord." So here you have a nation that is making their nest as high as the eagle, and the Lord says, "I'll bring you down." Now, what nation does that remind you of, maybe? How about the nation whose symbol is the eagle, right? That we are at the top. We think we're the greatest, the strongest, the best, the most exceptional, full of our pride. And just a sampling of car bumpers will tell you when you read "proud to be an America," "American," "proud to be an American," "American pride," and so on. You know, "these colors don't run," blah, 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 whatever. You know, I mean, we're full of it. We are the embodiment of this verse. And what does the Lord say? He says, "I will bring thee down from thence, saith the Lord." But why did they feel this way? It's because of their station. They had made it to the top. They were a powerful nation. And they let it get to their head, just as we have. Look at in the minor prophet in Obadiah 3 through 4. Obadiah here likewise is prophesying against the same people, against Edom. Obadiah, Jonah, Micah. Let's see. Here we go. Obadiah 1:3-4. Says, "The pride of thine heart hath deceived thee." You see how thinking more highly of yourself than you should will end up deceiving you into thinking that you're something better than you are. "Thou that dwellest in the clefts of the rock, whose habitation is high, that saith in his heart, Who shall bring me down to the ground?" This is what nations like Edom and like the United States and like every empire, this is what they think. Who's going to bring us down? Who's going to mess with us? We're the best. We're the most powerful. We're the superpower, right? Look at what God says. "Though thou exalt thyself as the eagle," there it is again, "and though thou set thy nest among the stars, that thence will I bring thee down, saith the Lord." Now, this is quite interesting to me. Here you have a nation that is exalting itself like the eagle and has set their nest among the stars. And look at the United States, the eagle, and we have our space program where we send men out into the stars or send spacecraft out there, supposedly we do anyway. And so here we've made our nest in the stars, put a man on the moon, they tell us anyway. I'm not sure I buy it. But anyway, the point is they say they did anyway. And what does God say? "I'm going to bring thee down." I just find that kind of interesting. But bringing it back down from nations to individuals here, we often deceive ourselves into thinking that we are something when we are nothing. Look at Galatians 6 and verse 3. Galatians 6 and verse 3. It says, "For if a man think himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceiveth himself." And there are plenty of people out there that fall into this category. We've probably met people like this before. Maybe we've even been people like this before, God forbid. We probably all, especially in our younger days, really thought we were something. And then we look back now on what we were then when we really thought we were something, right? When we were in high school or in our 20s or something, when we think you're on top of the world. And you look back and you think, I was nothing, but yet I thought I was really something, right? I'm sure we've all been there. There's actually a name for this. It's called delusions of grandeur. You may have heard this term before. And this is actually in the OED. It's under the definition of delusion, number 3. It says anything that deceives the mind with a false impression. This is delusion in general here. A deception, a fixed false opinion or belief with regard to objective things, especially as a form of mental derangement. See, people that think they're something when they're nothing are deranged, mentally deranged. And then it gives us here this phrase, delusions of grandeur. A false belief concerning one's personality or status, which is thought to be more important than it is. And this is all over the place. I think I probably told you, and it's somehow it's stuck in my mind because this woman was so ridiculous, but I saw a woman walking across Walmart one day with a t-shirt that said, I think she said, I'm really a big deal or something. And she really was a big deal. I mean, she was like this wide. But I just thought, I mean, how deluded and deceived can you possibly be to think that you are a big deal when it is an objective fact that you are not? And I can just tell that by looking at you. That's just kind of, that's what you call irony there, if you ask me. But we've all met people who think that they're great singers, right? You ever meet somebody that thinks they're a great singer? You ever watch American Idol, you know, that stupid show about people that want to be famous singers, and they get up there, and there are people, obviously everybody trying out thinks they're a great singer, and you know what? They have family members and friends who are also idiots that think they're a great singer because they wouldn't be going up there if other people wouldn't have told them, hey, go up here and try out, and they really think they're wonderful singers. But the fact is they are not, right? This is delusions of grandeur here. Or great writers. You know, you ever read somebody that thinks they're a great writer and they use all this highfalutin language to try to cover up the fact that they really don't know how to write, but they just try to make it sound like they do using these big words and acting all smart and everything, but they're not really good writers? Or how about people that think they're great intellectuals that really aren't? Now, this is usually a group of people, and I didn't come up with this term myself. I heard this term, and I think it's fitting. These are people you call midwits. Right? They're not dimwits. It doesn't mean they're not stupid people. They have above average intelligence, but they're not super smart, but they're right in that mid category, you know, somewhere between average and smart midwits. And these are the ones that really think they're so smart. And they think, you know, because they've listened to some pundit or something and they can repeat back some talking point or something that they have the world figured out or something. So there's lots of people out there that think they're, especially in the age of social media, that think they're so bright. And anybody can sound smart when you're on social media, because anytime you're arguing with somebody, you can just go to Google and do all your research there while you're writing and make it sound like you know so much when you might not hardly know anything. You're just going to Google and finding things. But anyway, or, you know, people that think they're great at sports, great sports players. I'm sure we've all, when we played sports when we were kids, you always knew the kid that was horrible but thought he was so great, right? And you feel bad for the poor guy. Or people that think they're great musicians, right, that aren't, right? You probably, you know, it's cute when you're a little kid, you know, but when you're not a little kid and you really think you're awesome and you know, you're not that great, you know, some people have really deceived themselves. But so anyway, those are just some examples of people that are that have been caught up in this delusions of grandeur thing, that are really impressed with themselves, but they're really not all that impressive. So it's good in that, with those type of things, is just to try to take an objective look at yourself and say, am I really as good as I think I am? Or if you're courageous enough, actually ask somebody objectively, do you think I'm good at whatever this is, if you even want to know. You know, like when I ask my wife if I'm a good singer or something, you know, and then I find out, turns out I'm really not Barry Manilow after all. So anyway, just as an example, I do not have any delusions of grandeur when it comes to my singing, okay? I've Actually, I probably did it when I was a little kid. I thought I was a good singer, and then somebody told me that I wasn't. And then pretty much after that point, then I realized, well, I don't have it when it comes to that department. But people like this, they view themselves highly because of their pride. That's really what it comes down to. Pride is the quality of being proud, a high or overweening opinion of one's own qualities, attainments, or estate, which gives rise to a feeling and attitude of superiority over other or over and contempt for others, inordinate self-esteem. So pride is whenever you think better of yourself than you really are, and that you, as a result of that, want to look down on other people. And that's typical of proud people, because in order to bring themselves up, they must push others down, right, in their own mind, or maybe even the way that they'll talk. And they'll you know, some people, well, just tell you that they're better than so-and-so, or so-and-so, he is not really that good. He's not, you know, they always like to try to put other people down to lift themselves back up. And that's why they have such a high opinion of themselves. But to admit the truth about themselves would wound their lofty self-image, and so they can't do that. They don't want to know the truth about themselves. Such people have deceived themselves, but they haven't deceived very many other people, right? They think that they're really something, but most other people can, you know, look at it objectively and determine that they're not. So such a person needs to honestly evaluate and prove his own works before he rejoices in it. Look at Galatians 4, or 6 and verse 4. This would just be the couple of verses after the one that we just looked at, where it said that if a man thinks himself to be something when he's nothing, he deceiveth himself. And then verse 4, but let every man prove his own work, and then shall he have rejoicing in himself alone and not in another. So prove your own work. And then if you really have determined that, well, I am really good at this, I guess then you can rejoice in it if you want to. But you got to be careful with that, because remember what the Bible says, that what hast thou that thou hast not received? So even if you are good at something, well, you're only good at it because God gave you that ability, right? So it's not something to glory in and rejoice in anyway. Now, people often deceive themselves when they want to do something, even though they know that it's not godly or wise to do so. And I want to talk about this. This is a really important part here when it comes to self-deception. And it's very insidious. This whole thing, it happens a lot, and we really have to examine ourselves to see if we're doing this. Because the thing with self-deception and deception in general is, when you're deceived, you don't know you're deceived, right? So it behooves us all to consider our ways and see, have I done this before? Am I doing this now, right? Or in the future? Be on the lookout for this. Am I deceiving myself because I really just want to do something that I know is probably not wise? Maybe it's even wrong or sinful, but maybe it's just even not wise, but I just want to do it so badly that I want to talk myself into it. Now, the reason why people do this is because, at least with children of God have a conscience. And it accuses them when they do something, when they knowingly do something that is sinful or that is wrong or is just maybe foolish, right? So sinful is definitely bad. Wrong is, you know, kind of like a lesser degree of sinful, I guess. And foolish is, you know, the thought of foolishness is sin. So foolishness can be sinful. Or maybe it's just unwise. Maybe it's just not straight up full-blown sinful, but it's just not wise, right? There are things out there that you can do that maybe you haven't actually broken a law of God, but it's just not wise, right? So we all want to be careful about that. But what happens, the point is that our conscience will accuse us if we knowingly are doing something that is wrong or sinful or even unwise. And what happens then? Well, let me give you the conscience verses first, and then I'll tell you what happens. Romans chapter 2 and verse 15. Romans chapter 2 and verse 15. This is true of children of God. People that are not children of God, their conscience is defiled, so this doesn't necessarily apply to them, but it does to us. Romans 2 and verse 15, it says, speaking of these Gentiles which know not the law, but do by nature the things contained in the law, and they are a law unto themselves. It says, which show the work of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and their thoughts the meanwhile accusing or else excusing one another. So their conscience is bearing them witness, and it is either accusing them when they do something they know is wrong, or it is excusing them when they know that whatever they're doing is actually okay, even though maybe other people or society or somebody's telling them what they're doing is wrong, they know it's okay. You know, for instance, maybe they grew up in this fundamentalist church which says that it's wrong to ever have a sip of alcohol. And yet, they've read the Bible now, and their conscience tells them there's nothing wrong with that. So their conscience excuses them when other people are saying, no, you shouldn't do that. And their conscience says, no, that's just fine. Or, on the other hand, their conscience will be accusing them when they're doing something that they know the Bible said not to do, and now their conscience is, it's that little voice on your shoulder that's telling you, you shouldn't do that. Why are you doing this? Don't do that, right? So that's what they have this conflict going on. And in Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 2, we read about the sacrifices under the law of Moses. And those sacrifices had to continually be made every year. The high priest had to go into the holiest every year and sprinkle everything with blood to purge the sins, because there was still a conscience of those sins in the people. The sins actually hadn't been put away, and so they were still feeling guilty about them. Hebrews chapter 10 and verse 2, "For then would they not have ceased to be offered, because that the worshippers, once purged, should have no more conscience of sins." See, if those offerings and sacrifices would have put away those sins, the worshipers then wouldn't have had their conscience pricking them, feeling like they're still under the guilt of that sin, because the sin would have been gone. So the point is, whenever we knowingly do something sinful, wrong, foolish, unwise, our conscience makes us feel guilty, it makes us feel uneasy, it makes us feel stressed out and uncomfortable. We just don't like that feeling. Like, nobody likes the feeling of knowing that you're doing something wrong, that this just isn't a good idea. But at the same time, you just really want to do it, right? You just really want to do it. People don't like having that feeling. But, oh, I just want to do this. I mean, I really want to do this thing. I've been thinking about this for a long time. So what are you going to do? Well, you could just not do the thing, right? There's an idea. But if you really want to do it, and yet you don't want to feel this nagging conscience, you know what you do? You must deceive yourself and convince yourself that what you want to do is actually okay. You see, and then that solves the problem. Now I don't have that nagging conscience anymore, because I've convinced myself that this thing that I want to do is actually okay. As a matter of fact, it's a good idea. I don't know why my conscience was bothering me about this all this time, because now I realize, now that I've thought about this forever, it's actually a good idea. I don't know how I missed it. And now, no conscience problem. You can just go on and do that thing you wanted to do. And, you know, you don't have that nagging voice in the back of your head anymore. Well, then what happens is, then they talk to themselves. And they talk to themselves enough that they're able to rationalize away the reasons that they should not do it, right? How does that saying go? You should talk to yourself, not listen to yourself. I heard a preacher say that one time. Talk to yourself, don't listen to yourself. When I say they talk to themselves, they're really listening to themselves, right? They're not talking sense into themselves. They're listening to their own nonsense, and they're rationalizing away the reasons why they shouldn't do it. So instead of saying no to themselves quickly, they just keep mulling it over in their mind. I remember, I think it was Jim Rohn I heard in the Detroit church. He was exhorting young people. I think maybe it was graduation time, or I don't remember what it was. It was something anyway. He was talking to young people, and he said, learn to say no quickly. And that's really important when it comes to fleeing from sin or making wise decisions. Learn to say no quickly. Because if you mull it around for a while, and you think about it for a while, and you consider it for long enough, and before you know it, you've convinced yourself it's really okay. The more they think about it, the more acceptable it becomes to them. And we really want to watch out for this. Then what happens? So first of all, so you got this thing you just really want to do, and you're feeling guilty about it, so you got to deceive yourself. So this is the process of deceiving yourself. First, you start talking to yourself about it and rationalizing away all the reasons why you shouldn't do it. Then you talk to other people about it, whom you know will validate what you want to do. Okay? 2 Chronicles 18 and verses 3 through 5. This is what King Ahab did whenever he and Jehoshaphat created an affinity, and Ahab wanted to go to war against Ramoth Gilead, and Jehoshaphat had enough sense to think, I don't know if this is a good idea or not. Why don't we get some counsel from the Lord? Is there a prophet of the Lord that we can talk to? Ahab doesn't want to do this, of course, because he's a fool and he just wants to do what he wants to do, and he doesn't want anybody to tell him that it might not be a good idea. But he figures, hey, he needs Jehoshaphat's help, so he'll go along with it. So in 2 Chronicles 18, verses 6 through 7, it says, "But Jehoshaphat said, is there not here a prophet of the Lord besides that we might inquire of him? And the king of Israel said unto Jehoshaphat, there is yet one man by whom we may inquire of the Lord." I think, I got too far down the line. Okay, verses 3 through 5. 3 through 5. Pardon me, I'm sorry. I got down to my next point. My eyes went to the wrong place in the verse. So forget about that right now. Verses 3 through 5. So what happens then is Jehoshaphat wants to go get counsel from a prophet of the Lord, and Ahab agrees to it. Okay, so verses 3 through 5. "And Ahab, king of Israel, said unto Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, wilt thou go with me to Ramoth Gilead? And he answered him, I am as thou art, my people is thy people, and we will be with thee in the war. And Jehoshaphat said unto the king of Israel, inquire, I pray thee, at the word of the Lord today." You see, Jehoshaphat was being stupid because he agreed to do something dumb before he even asked counsel to see if it was a good idea. He agrees to it and he says, well, oh, actually, you know what? Why don't we talk to the prophet just to make sure it's okay, right? Bad idea. You should, number one, you shouldn't have made affinity with a wicked king like Ahab in the first place, right? Evil communication corrupts good manners. He that walketh with wise men shall be wise, but a companion of fools shall be destroyed. So you should have never done that, and you shouldn't have bought into Ahab's deception either, because you know what Ahab did? Jehoshaphat comes to him in verse 2, and Ahab kills a bunch of sheep and oxen in abundance for him and his people, right? Every man is a friend to him that giveth gifts, right? He butters him up, right? Remember what we're told, love not his dainty meats, right? When he says, come eat and drink with thee, his heart is not with thee, in Proverbs. So Jehoshaphat was stupid enough to go along with Ahab, and then he immediately agrees before he even gets counsel, and then he thinks, oh, we should probably get counsel, right? Better late than never, but once you've already agreed to it, you're pretty much screwed, and you're going to end up doing whatever you probably agreed to anyway, regardless of what the prophet says. So, verse 4, "And Jehoshaphat said unto the king of Israel, inquire, I pray thee, at the word of the Lord today. Therefore the king of Israel gathered together of the prophets 400 men, and said unto them, shall we go to Ramoth Gilead to battle, or shall I forbear? And they said, go up, for the Lord will deliver it into the king's hand." So they tell him what he wants to hear. Why do you suppose that is? Oh, probably because these were the prophets that were fed at the king's table. These were the prophets that were the yes men, right? And Ahab calls the 400 prophets, the false prophets, and gets counsel from them. In other words, he went to talk to people whom he knew would validate what he wanted to do. And what usually happens is you're either going to go to two types of people when you want to get validation. You're going to go to weak people who, you know, even if they disagree with you, don't have the heart and the guts to tell you, bad idea, don't do this. So you're going to go to weak people that are just going to go along with it just because, right, they don't have the courage to stand up to you. Or you're going to go to stupid people who are not smart enough to even realize what you're doing is dumb. And they're going to say, oh, sounds like a good idea to me. Yeah, go ahead. This is what happens. So you go to people that are going to validate what you want to do. This feeds into the self-deception. See, now a person like this, now he has validation from other people, likely foolish people, for what he wants to do. You see, now he's not in this alone. Now he's got other people that tell him, hey, this is a good idea. Yeah, go ahead. You see, now people like this can tell themselves and others that they sought advice before making the decision. You see how this works? Right? Oh, I know I'm supposed to get advice. Well, I got advice. I didn't make this decision on my own. I didn't do this flippantly. I went and talked to other people. And everybody I talked to thought it was a good idea. Right? Talk to people that you knew we're either not going to oppose you or that we're going to be on your side. Then they avoid talking to anyone about it whom they perceive would disapprove of it, and we try to talk them out of it. And this is the case with King Ahab. When Jehoshaphat heard the 400 prophets say, oh, go up and prosper, the Lord will deliver it into thy hand. And Jehoshaphat thinks, well, these guys all seem like they're with one consent here, and it seems like they're all just rubber stamping what the king wants to do. Might there be another prophet out there? Maybe we could get a second opinion, or maybe a 401st opinion, since the first 400 were morons. Maybe we can get another one. Verses 6 through 7 and 17. But Jehoshaphat said, is there not here a prophet of the Lord besides that we might inquire of him? See, Jehoshaphat's at least a wise man. He's got the consensus of 400 prophets, and he's like, is there maybe somebody else? Maybe we could try to find just one more. Verse 7, and the king of Israel said unto Jehoshaphat, there is yet one man by whom we may inquire of the Lord, but I hate him. For he never prophesied good unto me, but always evil, the same as Micaiah the son of Imlah. And Jehoshaphat said, let not the king say so. Yeah, Ahab says, well, there is this one guy, but I hate him because he always prophesies falsely against me. Every time I want to do something, this guy says, nope, not a good idea. And I'm just tired of talking to him. I don't like talking to people that tell me that I shouldn't do what I want to do. But they went and talked to Micaiah. And you know what they tried to do? The people that were sent from Micaiah says, hey, all the prophets are prophesying good to the king. They're all saying, go up to Ramoth-Gilead. Just say what they say. And Micaiah says, I'm going to say what the Lord tells me to say. And then he does have a bit of mockery there where he just says, oh, go up and prosper. They'll be delivered in your hand. And then, you know, the king says, come on, tell me the truth. You know, quit fooling around with me. And in verse 17, and then he tells him the truth, tells him to go home, basically. And the king of Israel said to Jehoshaphat, did I not tell thee that he would not prophesy good unto me, but evil? You see, I knew he was going to say, don't do it. That's why I didn't even want to talk to him. What's the point of talking to somebody that's going to tell me to not do what I want to do? Right? I mean, I only want to talk to people that are going to validate what I want to do. So they avoid talking to anyone whom they perceive would disapprove of what they want to do, and we try to talk them out of it. This feeds into the self-deception even further. They can now tell themselves that nobody thinks this is a bad idea. You see how that works? I only went and talked to people I knew were going to tell me it was a good idea. I intentionally avoided talking to anybody that I knew was going to say what I wanted to do was not a good idea. And now I can tell myself, everybody thinks this is a good idea. I haven't talked to one single person out there that thinks that this is a bad idea. Well, yeah, because you intentionally did not ask anybody that you thought might tell you it's not a bad idea. So now I've got counsel, and furthermore, everybody unanimously thinks that this is a wonderful idea. You see how the self-deception is being accomplished here? Then they avoid getting the pastor's advice on the matter. They instead inform the pastor of their plans or decisions as a courtesy to him, but they never actually seek his counsel. There's a big difference, brethren, between informing somebody of what you're going to do and seeking counsel. Now, a lot of people, they inform and then they tell themselves, oh, I've sought counsel. But you have to ask yourself, did I actually seek counsel? This happens a lot. This feeds into the self-deception because now they can tell themselves that the pastor's okay with it, even though the pastor didn't say he's okay with it. You see? Well, I talked to the pastor and he's okay with it. Well, did you actually ask the pastor if he's okay with it? When you went to the pastor, did you just tell him what you were already going to do and then the pastor just kind of nods and says, doesn't say much. Is that the pastor said it was okay? Or did you actually ask the pastor for advice and counsel? Did you actually ask what he thinks you should do? Did you go up and say, Pastor, what do you think I should do in this situation? I'm thinking of doing this. What do you think I should do? Or, Pastor, if you were me, if you were in my shoes, what would you do? There's a big difference between asking those questions and saying, hey, you know, I've been thinking about doing this. I'm going to do this, you know, and I'm really looking forward to it, and da-da-da. And then the pastor says, interesting. He didn't say much. That is not the pastor saying, yep, that's a good idea. That's the pastor saying, sounds like a dumb idea to me, but you didn't actually ask for advice, so I'm not going to say anything. I knew a guy one time, brother in another church that's no longer in the church, and he would tell me things, you know, oh, I talked to Tim, you know, Pastor Bobby. I talked to Tim, and you know, he's good with it. And I'm just thinking, really? I just find that really hard to believe that you talked to Pastor Boffy and he's good with it. More than likely, you probably said to Pastor Boffy something in passing about what you were already planning to do, and Pastor Boffy probably knows that he talked to you about this before and told you it was a dumb idea, and he probably said, huh. And that was, Pastor Boffy's okay with it. Yeah. More than likely, that was the case. Now look, I'm not telling you to do anything I haven't done myself and that I don't do myself. I have made it a point in my life for a long time to seek counsel before I make any major decision. And I do this all the time. Before, when I was dating, I talked to my pastor friends. When I started dating Seth, she's from the Philippines, right? And I thought, you know, there are people from the Philippines that want to get green cards. And I talked to my pastor friends and said, you know, what do you think about this? And I explained to them what she was like and what, you know, she seemed legitimate to me, but what do you guys think? Before I got engaged, I talked to my pastor friends. Do you think, from what you know, do you think this is a good woman? Is this a good idea? Do you think I'm right here for thinking about doing this? Before we got married, right? Before I started any number of failed business attempts. See, it's their fault. If they wouldn't have told me it was okay, I'd have never done it. It's their fault. But every one of those things, I called up my pastor friends and said, hey, what do you think? Here's the business model. Here's how much it costs. Here's this and that and whatever. And said, what do you think? All right? And they all, I mean, they thought, I mean, it sounds okay. It's not an insane amount of money. If you do lose, you're not going to go bankrupt or something. And it sounds like it'll work. But, you know, who knows? But you know, before we bought the house up there, or the trailer, whatever, you know, I talked to my pastor friends, talked to a couple members of the church, had them come over and look at it with me, but asked my pastor friends, what do you think of this? Does this sound like a good idea to you? Is there any reason I shouldn't do this? Of course, with church problems and decisions and that kind of thing, I always, always talk to them if it's anything of any, you know, serious consequence. So I'm not telling you to do anything I don't do myself. And I can honestly say, and if you don't believe me, call them up and ask them, that whenever I call them up, I don't tell them and go on for 5 minutes about what I'm going to do and why I'm going to do it, and then just say, hey, just wanted to let you know. No, I briefly tell them what I'm thinking about doing, and here's what I'm thinking. What would you do if you were in my shoes? What do you think I should do? Is there something wrong with doing this? Like, I actually legitimately really ask for counsel, because I really want to know. I want to make a wise decision. Now, if people do ask for the pastor's advice, sometimes it's merely just with the hope that he'll rubber stamp what they've already decided to do. It's like they're going with their fingers crossed behind their backs and saying, hey, I want to do this, pastor. Do you think this is a good idea? What do you think? And they're like, oh, just please say yes. Please say yes. Because they just want the rubber stamp. They're not really asking for advice, even though, I mean, those words are coming out of their mouth, but they're really in their heart not wanting the advice because they've already determined what they want to do. They can then tell themselves that they didn't disregard or go against the pastor's advice because his advice was based on his lack of understanding, right? Because, oh, I missed a point. So if the pastor advises them against it, yeah, if the pastor advises them against it, then they will rationalize away his advice by telling themselves that he doesn't really understand the situation. So you go to the pastor and you ask for advice, and then when he tells you not a good idea, I wouldn't do that, and here's the reason. And then they can say, well, you know, he just doesn't understand. He doesn't understand the situation. He's young, maybe. Once he's been around for longer, once he's had more experience, then he'll understand, but he doesn't get it right now. And, you know, I'm not rejecting his advice because he just doesn't get it. You know, it's just lack of understanding. It's okay, you know, I'm not going to hold that against him. But you see how this is how the self-deception works. Because anything that goes against what I want to do, then we rationalize that away and say, he didn't understand, right? That's how it works. You see, whenever you get in a position like this, your ways are right in your own eyes. And probably no, it's going to be a rare thing that anybody's going to talk you out of it. Proverbs 12 and verse 15. That's why I'm preaching about this. That's why I want to try to bring this to your attention. I'm probing deep down into human nature. Deep down into human nature. You may be sitting there and thinking, wow, you are like describing the innermost part of my being, and I've done this before, and how do you know about this? Well, because, you know, it says, face answereth to face, so the heart of man to man. I'm a man. I understand this stuff. I know what it's like to really want to do something and to convince myself that I want to do it and go talk to people and try to convince them to tell me it's okay, right? I know human nature. I understand how people think. Proverbs 12 and verse 15. Believe me, I fight against this myself. Everybody does. Proverbs 12, 15, the way of a fool is right in his own eyes. But he that hearkeneth unto counsel is wise. You see, the fool thinks, oh, I know what I'm doing. I don't even need to ask for help. And anybody that tells them not a good idea, they'll say, why did I even bother asking that guy? He didn't know anything. You see, people like that aren't wise enough to seek counsel. He that hearkeneth unto counsel is wise. Their ways are clean to them, but God and other wise men around them are not so fooled. Proverbs 16 and verse 2. Just like with Ahab, do you think God was fooled by Ahab because he went to the prophet and asked for counsel? God wasn't fooled. God knew what he was up to. God knew that he just wanted to do what he wanted to do, and he was just going as a formality to talk to the prophet. Proverbs 16 and verse 2 says, all the ways of a man are clean in his own eyes, but the Lord weigheth the spirits. You can tell the Lord whatever you want to, but the Lord searches the hearts. The Lord weighs the spirits. The Lord, in case you didn't know, is a lot smarter than you. He knows you a lot better than you know you, and he's not going to be fooled by your BS. And most other people aren't either. Most other people just don't have the guts to tell you about it. Proverbs 21 and verse 2. Proverbs 21 and verse 2. Every way of a man is right in his own eyes, but the Lord pondereth the hearts. I mean, isn't that the truth? Don't we always think that we're right? Right? And even when we're wrong, don't we try to convince ourselves that we're right? Because, you know, nobody likes to feel like they're wrong. But the Lord knows. You see, people like this, and I say people like this, I mean all of us, when we act like this, and we all do from time to time, their ways seem right to them, but the end thereof are going to end in destruction. Proverbs 16 and verse 25, case in point, remember Ahab. Ahab went to the prophets for counsel, right? And he didn't want to hear what they had to say. And whenever he gets counsel against what he wants to do, he does it anyway. And guess what happened to Ahab? He got killed. He got an arrow through his chest. And he deserved it. Proverbs 16:25. There is a way that seemeth right unto a man, but the end thereof are the ways of death. I just can't read this verse without thinking of that situation that I told you about a long time ago back in Minneapolis when I was first only like a year in the ministry, and this guy was doing something that I told him, you cannot do this. You're gonna be excluded for this, that you can't do this. And then when I find out he did it, I say, why did you do that? Well, it just seemed like the right thing to do. Luckily he was on the phone, or I would have probably choked him out. Not really. I'm not a striker, but I felt like strangling the guy. Just seemed like the right thing to do. I can still hear him saying that. Oh, seemed like the right thing to do. Oh, telling you what. If I felt like being like Nehemiah and ripping his hair out if he'd have been present. Now, what happens is if we reject the advice from friends and people like that, eventually our friends, or family, or pastor, whoever, they're going to stop offering the advice. Job 32 and verse 1. Job 32 and verse 1. So these three men ceased to answer Job because he was righteous in his own eyes. They finally, these are Job's three friends that had spent 30, you know, some chapters there trying to talk some sense into Job. Now, granted, a lot of their counsel was not right, and you can read that, and you can see that they were not right in a lot of their counsel, but some of their counsel was right. But you know what? They decided, you know what? Job's righteous in his own eyes. He's not going to listen to what I say anyway. I'm just going to stop talking. And that's what your friends will eventually do too. If you actually had friends that were courageous enough to give you good counsel and to tell you when you were wrong, if you just reject it over and over again, they're just going to quit offering it. You know, sometimes if people are close enough to you, they'll offer you, if they love you, they'll offer you unsolicited advice. I realize that that's most of the time useless because most people don't pay attention to it. But, you know, I've had my pastor friends different times where I'm talking about something and they'll say, like, well, I mean, you didn't, in this situation maybe, you didn't ask, but, you know, do you mind if I tell you something? Oh, absolutely, please. I just, you know, I forgot to even ask. Please, yeah, tell me. And then they, you know, say whatever they're going to say. And a lot of times I'm like, yeah, good idea. Yeah, I didn't think about that. But anyway, so either they'll just stop giving you unsolicited advice, or maybe they'll just say, you know what, you just keep coming to me, and I keep telling you what to do, and you just keep rejecting everything I tell you. Just quit talking to me, right? I mean, I'm sure we've had situations like that with people, too, that they just keep coming back and asking you the same things again, and you're finally like, just quit asking. You're not paying attention anyway. This is why it's crucial to get good counsel and to get good counsel early and to avoid self-deception. Proverbs 11:14. I'm just going to give you a string of verses here that I've given you before. The Bible obviously has a lot to say about getting counsel. Proverbs 11 and verse 14. Where no counsel is, the people fall, but in the multitude of counselors, there is safety. Multitude of counselors. So it's always good to get a second opinion on things. It's funny how people will get a second opinion whenever the news is bad. You go to the doctor and he says you've got cancer. Most people aren't going to say, well, I guess that's it. What are most people going to do? They're going to get a second opinion whenever the news is bad news, right? But how many times, just think about this, how many times you go to the doctor and he says, clean bill of health, you are in perfect health, and you're like, I'm going to get a second opinion about that. You know, we never do that, right? We like good news, and we're certainly not going to contradict that. Proverbs 15 and verse 22. Proverbs 15, 22. Without counsel, purposes are disappointed, but in the multitude of counselors, they are established. So yeah, the things that you want to do might end up being a disappointment if you don't get counsel, because remember, there are things that each of us in our own lives that we can't see. It's blinded by what we want to do, or it's just blinded by we're just too familiar with the situation or whatever, and we can't see it. But other people can see it really easily. So if we get counsel, our purposes won't end up being disappointed. Proverbs 20 and verse 18. Every purpose is established by counsel, and with good advice make war. One of the most important things I think a president of the United States should do is get an outstanding cabinet of counselors. Because no president, no man is going to be smart enough, even if he is a good man, and even if he is a wise man, no president is going to know everything that he needs to know about all the things that he's supposed to do, right? I mean, just foreign policy alone. What president is going to know all the intricacies of all these other foreign countries that we deal with and things? Nobody's going to know all that stuff. So it is crucial to get good people around you. I just wish Donald Trump would have done that. I'm serious. Because some of the things he said were good, and then he went and he wanted to drain the swamp, and he nominated every swamp creature he could find to be in his cabinet. People that were diametrically opposed to what he wanted to do, like Pompeo and all these other guys, John Bolton, which he finally fired, thankfully, but guys like that are totally opposed to what he said he wanted to do. If I were ever elected president, the first thing that I would do is I would probably talk to a guy like Ron Paul and say, can you tell me people that I should ask for help from? Like, I'd go to somebody that I think is really wise, and then I'd say, you find other people to come to my cabinet because I'm not even smart enough to know the people that I should ask for help. So you tell me who are good people that I can get here that can help me out. That's the first thing I'd do. And the next thing I would do is systematically dismantle the federal government. That's what I would try to do next. But anyway, I'd need good counsel to do that. And I need really good bodyguards and bulletproof glass around me everywhere I went. Proverbs 24 and verse 6. For by wise counsel thou shalt make thy war, and in multitude of counselors there is safety. You know, if George Bush wouldn't have surrounded himself with a bunch of neocon, warmongering, bloodthirsty miscreants, we wouldn't have been involved in those horrible wars that massacred over 1 million people and lost ourselves tens of thousands. Was it tens of thousands? Many soldiers, anyway, in the thousands and then tens of thousands wounded and all that. We wouldn't have got involved in all those wicked wars if George Bush would have gotten himself some good counsel and not let Dick Cheney run the White House for him. Now, it's been my observation during nearly 38 years of life, 15 years of being a Christian in true churches, and 7 years of pastoring, that very few people sincerely seek counsel before deciding to do something that they want to do. And that's just a fact. I've just noticed that in my life, just in general. I'm not talking not only here, not only in Minneapolis, not only anywhere. Just in general, it has been my observation that very few people sincerely seek counsel before making decisions that they want to do. When they really want to do something, they are not going to get counsel from anybody. That's what I've found. And it's even true of people that have heard me repeatedly exhort. I mean, this is not the first time in a sermon you've heard me to exhort you to get counsel. I mean, this is kind of like one of my soapboxes. It's even true of people that have heard me repeatedly exhort brethren from the scriptures of the importance of seeking counsel before making major life decisions. Now, I thought maybe it's just because I'm young. You know, I'm younger than most of the people that I pastor. Maybe they just think that I don't know anything, so why go talk to somebody who doesn't know anything, right? He could be my kid or whatever. I'm not going to talk to him. I thought maybe it's just my age. Maybe that's what it is. So I asked one of my pastor friends, which is, we'll just say mature. I don't want to call him old, but he's mature. You know, he's got a white head. And I asked him, I said, you know, has it been your experience that, you know, I mean, do people come to you when they really want to do something? Or they come to you for counsel often? I mean, do they really come and actually ask your opinion or advice about things? And I said, is it just me? And he's like, no, it's pretty much just the way it is. And I thought, oh, okay, so it's not my age. It's just that people don't like, you know, coming to anybody for counsel whenever they really want to do something. So I've just had to accept the fact that I'm contending with human nature, which is very hard to overcome. That's all. It's just human nature. And to try to convince somebody to not do something they really want to do is nigh unto impossible, first of all, because they'll never even ask. And even if they ask, it's really hard to convince somebody otherwise. So people will deceive themselves when they want to do something, and then they will deceive themselves after they've done something to try to convince themselves that it was really the right thing to do. Always remember that there are two reasons why somebody does something most of the time. There is the presented reason that they tell others, and they often tell themselves. And then there's the real reason, which rarely gets admitted to, but it's often not hard for others to perceive. Presented reason, this is what I tell myself and everybody else. And then there's the real reason, which I don't even want to admit to myself. I try to suppress that real reason as much as I can because I don't even want to, if I don't think about it long enough, and if I tell myself the presented reason enough times, then I'll actually start to believe myself. Let me just give you some examples here. Well, I'll give you some examples, but let me just talk about the presented reason first. Another name for the presented reason is the BS excuse, right? That's another name for presented reason. We tell the presented reason to ourselves because we don't want to admit the truth to ourselves. An example of this would be the servant that was given the one talent and he hid it in the earth instead of going and investing it and giving it back to his master with either with gain or at least with interest. You'll remember this parable in Matthew chapter 25, 24 through 25. Matthew 24 through 25. You remember the parable he gave to one 5 talents, to one 2 talents, to the one 1 talent. And the guy with the 5 went and traded and made 5 more. The guy with the 2 went and traded and made 2 more. He was happy with them and blessed them for it. And then in verse 24, then he which had received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I knew thee that thou art an hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown, and gathering where thou hast not strawed. And I was afraid, and went and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, there thou hast that is thine. That's the presented reason. The presented reason was, I knew thee that thou wert an hard man, and you reap where you haven't sown, and you gather where you haven't strawed. And I was afraid. That's the presented reason. That's what he told the master. That's what he tells himself. I was afraid because you're a hard master. But what was the real reason? See, the master cut right through the BS excuse, and he found out the real reason. Verse 26, his Lord answered and said unto him, thou wicked and slothful servant, thou knewest that I reap where I sowed not, and gather where I have not strawed. You knew all that already. You know what the problem was? He was lazy. That's what slothful means. The master wasn't buying it. Don't tell me about I'm a hard man. You knew I'm a hard man. You should have at least put it in the bank, and then I could have got mine own with usury. You're just too lazy. Not only are you lazy to invest it, you're too lazy to walk down to the bank and stick it in there. Get me some interest. You see, real versus presented reasons. You see, lazy people often use fear as an excuse for their laziness. Proverbs 22 and verse 13. I like this verse. Proverbs 22 and verse 13. Proverbs 22 and verse 13. It says, the slothful man saith, there is a lion without, I shall be slain in the streets. I can't go to work, it's dangerous out there. There's a lion out there, I could get eaten. But what's his real problem? He's slothful, he's lazy, he just doesn't want to go out and work. So he makes up an excuse, he's afraid. Many people today are using fear of the coronavirus as an excuse for not going back to work and staying on unemployment because they are lazy. That's what it is. Oh, I could get coronavirus if I went back to work. Yeah, because there are just so many 25-year-olds that are just dropping dead because of coronavirus, right? Like a whole 2 of them in the entire population or something. I could get the coronavirus. It's not that I want to sit at home and watch Netflix and play video games and make more than I was working. It's not that that's not what it is. I'm just afraid. Yeah, you are. You're afraid of work is what you're afraid of. See, his Lord didn't accept this BS excuse, and neither will our Lord, getting back to the guy that hid the talent in the earth. If you go back there to Matthew 25, I should have left my finger there. In Matthew 25, his Lord wasn't having this, and our Lord's not going to have it either. Thou oughtest, therefore, to have put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I should have received mine own with usury. Take therefore the talent from him, and give it unto him which hath 10 talents. For unto every one that hath shall be given, and he shall have abundance. But from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. So yeah, he wasn't taking it. Oh, verse 30, and cast ye the unprofitable servant into outer darkness, there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now we tell others the presented reason because we don't want to be embarrassed about what we did or why we did it. Right? Sometimes the real reason is really embarrassing. We would not want to admit the real reason we did something. So we tell the presented reason. And if you think about this, I guarantee you, if you really start thinking about it and just going back through events in your life, you'll find places where you have given people the presented reason and not the real reason. And I mean, it probably happens all, if you think about it, you just spend some time thinking, it happens all the time, all the time. Little things or big things, but you know, we come up with reasons why we do things, which are not really the actual reason. In order for us to not be convicted in our hearts about lying, we must first convince ourselves that the presented reason is the real reason before we try to convince others, right? You got to teach yourself first. So you got to convince yourself of it. And then once you've convinced yourself, then you can convince others. And many times we give the presented reason because we're afraid of what people might think if they knew the real reason, even though they usually probably do know the real reason. A lot of times people see through our nonsense, in case you haven't lived long enough to figure that out yet. We put up the smoke screen, but they're going to see right through it. Now, the real reason usually is not virtuous. It's usually embarrassing to admit, or at least it casts us in a negative light, and the real reason often comes down to simply wanting to fulfill our lusts and our desires. That's usually what it comes down to. What's the truth of the matter? I just wanted to do it. But I got to come up with all these reasons why I needed to do it, you know, because just to say, well, I just simply wanted it, you know, is not good enough. A lot of times we don't think. So let me give you some examples of presented versus real reasons. And there's tons of them, but these are just some of them that I thought of. Let's just say you get the latest iPhone, okay? Now look, I'm not condemning you if you have the latest iPhone, okay? I'm not condemning you. I'm just giving you examples here, okay? So what's the presented reason you got the latest iPhone? Well, my old one didn't have enough memory. I mean, the thing, it was just full. You know, I have to have those 1,500 pictures on there, and 1,490 would just be unacceptable, and therefore I've got to get this new phone because what am I going to do? Or it was getting slow. You know, I mean, when I click on an app, it was taking like 3 extra milliseconds for that thing to open up. What do you think? I'm going to waste my life waiting for apps to open up? I mean, I got stuff to do. I mean, come on. Or it was going to die any day. I mean, I just know it. It was just going to die. I could just tell it was just going to die. But what's the real reason? I wanted it. That's the real reason. A lot of times, maybe sometimes there, you know, there are real reasons, but a lot of times it's just, I wanted it. That's all. I mean, it's cool. It's got 3 cameras on it. I'm going to look cool slinging this thing around. I mean, Judy didn't even know it had 3 cameras on it. It had 3. I mean, it's cool. I mean, I pull this thing out, everybody's going to think, boy, this guy's hip. He's got 3 cameras on his phone. I got status now, you know. I got an iPhone, what is it, 10, 11, whatever it is. I'm cool. I've only got an iPhone 6S. I'm not that cool anymore, you know. I used to be cool 5 years ago when it was new, but I'm not cool anymore. Or how about this one? I have actually had people tell me this one, one of my favorites. You buy your children smartphones. Now, what's the presented reason? Well, they might need them to contact me in an emergency, right? I've heard people tell this to me. You know, my daughter's going over to sleepovers at somebody else's house, you know, a friend's house, and what if something happens and she needs to get a hold of me? She's got to have a cell phone. And I'm thinking, wow, yeah, that's right. Because I suppose the house that she's at doesn't have a phone, right? No home phone. Oh, no, nobody's got home phones anymore. I suppose both of her parents, they don't have cell phones then, do they? Well, her parents might not be there. So you're sending your teenage daughter over to a house party at one of her little friend's house with no parents present. There's a good idea. But I suppose the parents don't have phones, there's no home phone, and all 10 or 15 other little girls that are there, they all don't have phones, do they? Right? I mean, there's not a cell phone in this house. Right? We got 10 teenagers in this house and there is not a phone to be seen. If something happens, she's going to be dead. I'm never going to see her again because there was just no way for her to get a hold of me. Impossible. You're laughing because you know it's true. What was the real reason? The children wanted them and I capitulated because I was tired of hearing their whining. I didn't want to look like a mean parent in everyone else's eyes, and I didn't want my kids to be picked on by their peers for not having one. That's the real reason, if people would actually admit it. One of those things, probably. But the presented reason is, well, they have to be able to contact me in an emergency. And nobody in this church told me that example, so don't think I'm picking on somebody here. It was somebody else. Or how about this one? I just came up with this one just because it was kind of something that was on my mind. You close down a business that you were trying to get going. the presented reason, maybe. I didn't really like the products I was selling. I don't feel like working for myself anymore. I just want to go back and be an employee or something. Now, maybe those reasons are true. Or maybe the real reason is I was losing money and I wasn't profitable, you know. But nobody wants to say that I failed. That's why I closed the business down. Oh, I just didn't like it anymore. You know, all that money that I was making was just such a headache. It was just too much. You know, just having to deal with all the money and figuring out what to do with it all. And I just didn't like that. I wanted to go back for working for the man, you know. Or how about this one? Boy, this is a good one. You post a picture of your family on Facebook. What's the presented reason? I want our relatives to be able to see them. That's the presented reason. What's the real reason? I want to show off to all my, quote, friends and show what an awesome life that it appears that I have. I guarantee you that is what a lot of this posting pictures of your kids and your family and your outings and whatever you're doing, that's what it's all about. It's not about wanting the grandparents to be able to see what's going on. It's about showing off about how awesome your life appears to be. But guess what? Your life is just as lousy as everyone else's life. It just looks like everybody else has this great life because they're doing the same nonsense that you are, posting all these cute pictures about everything that they're doing, and their lives are just as boring and mundane as yours is. Or how about this one? You post a picture of your 4.0 GPA for this semester on Facebook. What is the presented reason for this? I just wanted to give God the glory for helping me get a 4.0. What's the real reason? I wanted to brag about it. Come on. You post a picture of yourself with a new necklace that you bought that just happens to show all your cleavage in the same picture, and you say, oh, I just got this new necklace. It's really, really nice, isn't it? Yeah, this is what people do. I went to a business meeting thing one time for it was a local businessman here. He's big into the travel industry, Christian professing fellow. And he was up there just telling us about basically how successful he was. But then he had to make it sound like he wasn't just up there boasting by saying, and you know, our agency here in Kansas City is like number 9 in the world. And just think what God can do with a little Kansas City. I'm thinking, yeah, what God can do. You're up there boasting about how wonderful your agency is and how it's number 9 in the country or whatever. But of course, you got to throw God in there to make it sound like you're so humble and thankful or whatever. How about this one? You stay at home and you don't go out and work. What's the presented reason? It's dangerous out there. Remember, there's a lion in the way. What's the real reason? I'm lazy. Or here's another one. This is one of my favorites. You run for political office. What's the presented reason? I want to serve the public. Right? I want to be a public servant. What's the real reason? I want a cushy job with power, prestige, and fringe benefits. That's what it comes down to. Okay, so how do you recognize if you're self-deceived? Remember, it's hard to recognize if you've been deceived because that's kind of the whole nature of deception. You don't realize it. So here's some things that you can do to figure out if you have self-deceived yourself. If you have avoided truly asking advice from wise people who you think will not agree with your plans or decisions, then there's a high likelihood that you have self-deceived yourself. So if you have avoided, let me say it again, if you have avoided truly asking advice from wise people that you think would not agree with your plans and decisions, you've probably deceived yourself. Number two, if you automatically dismiss the idea that you have deceived yourself, then you have probably deceived yourself. If you just listen to this and think, no, I don't do that. No way. I always tell myself the truth. I never try to convince myself to do something that I, you know, might not be the best idea. Well, chances are, if you just dismiss this outright, like this is not even possible that I've done this, you probably have. And number three, if you rationalize away the fact that you did not truly seek wise counsel before making a decision, you've probably self-deceived yourself. Well, I didn't really need to get counsel. I didn't really need to ask. When you rationalize it all away, well, you know, I didn't ask because, you know, I, whatever. That's a pretty good chance that you have deceived yourself. Now, how to avoid self-deception? Well, first you want to truly seek counsel before making an important decision. Remember the verses we read? I'm not going to read them to you again, but we already read them. In the multitude of counselors, there's safety, right? And the other verses like it. So if you want to avoid self-deception, truly seek wise counsel before making an important decision. I'm not talking about what you're going to have for lunch today. I'm not talking about simple decisions or what pair of shoes I should buy or something. I'm talking about when you're talking about major life decisions that are serious things that are going to have implications for years to come, those things you should definitely be getting counsel from somebody from that's a wise person that's not just going to tell you to go ahead and do what you want to do because they don't have a spine. If you know that what you're contemplating to do is sinful or unwise, tell yourself no immediately and keep telling yourself no every time the thought arises. So if you realize right now this is not a wise decision or this is outright sinful, tell yourself no. And keep every time you think about it, just say no. Just say it out loud. No, 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 no. I'm not thinking about this. I'm not doing it. If you have doubts in your conscience about a decision, stop and seek counsel before you sear your conscience, because that's the problem that you can get into. 1 Timothy 4 and verse 2, you can end up searing your conscience to the point where you totally think that you are doing the right thing when in times past you would have realized right away that this is the wrong thing. 1 Timothy 4 and verse 2, this is speaking of the latter days, speaking lies and hypocrisy, having their conscience seared with a hot iron. When you sear with a hot iron, you burn off all the nerves and you can't feel anything anymore. It's like the Apostle Paul. He said, I verily thought within myself that I ought to do many things contrary to the name of Jesus of Nazareth. He verily, truly thought that he was doing the right thing. That is a deceived person right there. And we don't want to get to that point. When you get to that point, the only thing that's going to get you out of a deception like that is a road to Damascus experience. When Christ comes and blinds you and totally, you know, just slays you. That's the only way you're going to get out of that. So you want to be careful not to get to that point. We don't want to be as other Gentiles are who have had their consciences seared. Look at Ephesians 4 and verse 19. Ephesians 4:19, Paul here speaks of these other Gentiles that we don't want to be like, who being past feeling have given themselves over unto lasciviousness to work all uncleanness with greediness. I am guessing, especially children of God, most children of God that got themselves into grievous sin, when it started out, they knew it was wrong. The first step in whatever that thing was, maybe they ended up having an adulterous affair or something or whatever, but that first step, or they got addicted to drugs, or they got addicted to alcohol, or whatever it might have been, some major thing that their life is in shambles now, but it goes back to that first decision when they knew they shouldn't have done it, but they just did it anyway. They talk themselves, oh, it's no big deal. Well, you know, it's, you know, I can do this. It's not, I'm not going to get addicted to it. You know, I can, oh, sure, I can flirt with this woman. It's not going to turn into anything. It's just, you know, it's just harmless flirting or whatever. You can just see how little bit at a time you deceive yourself and you convince yourself and you put away those thoughts that you're having, those accusing thoughts. And before you know it, you're down that path. We want to be really careful about that. Fourthly, we want to sincerely ask God to give us wisdom to make good decisions and to save us from ourselves. Look at James 1, 5 through 8. James 1, 5 through 8. If any of you lack wisdom, wisdom is, right, that sound sense to know how to choose the right means to get to the right ends. It's basically sound sense. Being able to make good decisions. If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask of God, that giveth to all men liberally and upbraideth not, and it shall be given him. But let him ask in faith, nothing wavering. For he that wavereth is like a wave of the sea, driven with the wind and tossed. For let not that man think that he shall receive anything of the Lord. A double-minded man is unstable in all his ways. You see here, when the Lord instructs us to ask for wisdom, what does he tell us? Ask in faith, nothing wavering. When you go to God, if you're asking for wisdom, but in the back of your mind you're holding back, If you're saying, Lord, I really want to know the truth, but in the back of your mind, you're saying, well, unless it means that I have to make some major life changes. Or unless, you know, I really want to find a true church, but in the back of your mind, you're saying, well, unless it means I have to move. Or unless it means I have to go against my family. Or unless, whatever. And if you've got something you're holding back in the back of your mind, and you're wavering, and you're saying one thing out of your mouth, but you're really thinking another thing, God's not going to give you wisdom. And it's the same with wisdom, with just ordinary, everyday, making good decisions wisdom. If you are asking, if you're going to God or to somebody else and you're asking counsel of them to make a wise decision, but in the back of your mind, you got your fingers crossed behind your back and you're just hoping they tell you what you want to hear, guess what? God's going to tell you what you want to hear. And chances are, what is the other guy going to tell you? He might just tell you what you want to hear because he knows that you really don't want to hear the truth. And then fifthly, be honest with yourself. Quit telling yourself BS excuses for doing things you do. Quit believing yourself when deep down you know better. Ask yourself, what is the real reason I did that? Like, get real, get serious with yourself. Why did I really do that? And ask yourself, am I really going to do what I just said I was going to do? Or am I just telling myself that to myself and others so that I look good? Just get real with yourself. Get honest with yourself. The only person you're going to harm when you're lying to yourself is yourself. I guess you could end up harming other people inadvertently, but you're mostly going to harm yourself. So that's what I have to say about self-deception. Next time, we're going to look at a couple of sermons. We're going to look at resisting deception. This, I was talking about just in the end of this, how to resist self-deception, but I'm going to be talking about in the next couple of sermons how to resist deception coming from without, coming from other people, not coming from within yourself. And it's probably a pertinent topic in today's day and age because there is a lot of mass deception going on out there all over the place.